Hare Krishna. Vanchakalpa trubhyascha kripa sindhu bheva cha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. So we are reading in the 11th canto, chapter 3, Liberation from the Illusory Energy, Sri Prabhuda. A Yogendra of that name has been instructing Maharaj Nimi in answer to his question, what is the swiftest or easiest way for somebody who's stupid or foolish to get pass over this insurmountable illusory energy? And so he has been explaining that one has to approach a spiritual master, and we've already seen that we've gone through some of the qualifications of that person that one should surrender to, and then in text 22, which we discussed last week, begins to describe the devotee, how the devotee who has accepted a spiritual master should behave. He should be Guru Vatma Daivataha, that is to say, accept the Guru as his own self and as his worshipable deity, serve him faithfully and without deceit, without duplicity. And in this way, the Lord, who gives himself, who is the Atma Atmada, the self who bestows himself onto the devotee, will bless the devotee in this way. And that was a previous text. Now we're starting with text 23. Actually, excuse me, I've got some cold or something. So text 23. In this text, now begins a description of further characterization of the disciple. And here, specifically, it's talking about how the disciple should relate to his world or and other people. It's already discussed the relationship with the spiritual master, and that's also included in this. But what it says here in text 23, sarvataha manasaha asangam. That parenthesis, little apostrophe, means that there's an A that's left out. If you look at the word for word, sarvataha manasaha asangam. The word asangam means without association. Sangha is association, as in sadhu sangha and so on, or even the group of people together is called a sangha. So this word asangha means free from ties, independent, having no attachment to or inclination for or interest in something. And so here, the first thing it says, sarvataha, which means everywhere, manasaha, there is, means we're talking about the mentality in the mind, this detachment. I think it's translated this way. A sincere disciple should learn to disassociate the mind from everything material. That's the purport of this. So there's this general sense of kind of detachment from everything, the whole material world. Sarvataha literally means everywhere. The word here in the Sanskrit is adau, which is somehow or other not in the translation. But adau means in the beginning. And so this is kind of a first qualification, early qualification, is this detachment of the mind from everything else, and then sangam. So there's asangam from maybe it means people in general. You know, I mean, when it says everywhere, we seem to be talking about people in this verse. It may mean, you know, just from the general run of society, which is certainly bad association, always has been, always will be, except maybe in Satyuga. it's the Gramya, you know, it's the village folks. So then there's asangam and then sangam, association or attachment, sadhushu, with saintly persons, with sadhus. The next part of the verse, the next line, is toward all beings. Bhuteshu, you see in the last line, bhuteshu, adha, yatochitam. And then relating to all beings in as suitable with these qualities, dayam, maitrim, and prashrayam. Dayam means mercy. Maitrim means friendship. And prashrayam means reverence. The word prashrayam literally means leaning forward, as when you're bowing to somebody. It means having a respectful demeanor, modesty, humbleness, affection. These are all from the Sanskrit dictionary, respect. This is prashrayam. And so what this means, you can see in the translation, this is unpacked a little bit. He should be merciful to those in an inferior position to him. Then that's the daya, mercy. What it says, this is toward people or living entities in general. These are the three sort of mercy, friendship, and reverence. As appropriate, this yata uchita, as appropriate. So that's why this is unpacked this way. What it means is merciful, that's appropriate to those who are in an inferior position to the disciple. Cultivate friendship with those on an equal level and meekly serve, this is prashrayam here, meekly serve those in a higher spiritual position. This lower, equal, and higher always has to do with spiritual advancement. Thus he should learn to deal properly with all living beings. So these are the social relationships. So there's a general detachment. All living beings or things in the material world or people in the material world from the very beginning. But then the attachment to these, to the saintly persons, and then there's these appropriate dealings here. If we look at the purport, there's a very long quotation from or citation from Madhvacharya in the beginning, which just seems to indicate that pure devotees are higher than the demigods and materialists and even rishis. Because all these are in the influence of the modes of material nature, but the pure devotee for whom one should be attached to, the sadhus, are those who are not under the control of material nature. If you look at the purport here, so that's what the thing Sri Madhvacharya seems to say this, then that, so therefore one should cultivate the association of the Uttama Adhikari. That's the second paragraph, and again we've already gone through that. On the other hand, then the third paragraph begins, on the other hand, one should avoid the association of a materialistic person, even if such a person is outwardly chanting the holy name of Krishna. Now this is taken from the fifth verse of the Upadeshamrita. So there may be, you may wonder, you know, who is a sadhu? So there are many people chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, and you may think that's okay, but it might not be, because that person is actually a materialist. They're still engaged in sense gratification and so on. So those people, that's why it says one should mentally honor the devotee who chants the holy name of Lord Krishna. So there may be many people who chant but are not really suitable for close association. And then, of course, the Upadeshamrita verse goes on to say, it also makes this distinction, one should mentally honor the devotee who chants the holy name of Lord Krishna, offer humble obeisances to the devotee who has undergone diksha and is engaged in worshiping the deity, associate with and faithfully serve that pure devotee who's advanced in undeviating devotional service and whose heart is completely devoid of the propensity to criticize others. Just to let you know that this this is, well, actually what the Sanskrit text says, which is quoted here, who's serving without deviation, bhajana vijnam ananyam Anyanitha, that's blasphemy or finding fault with others. But the Sanskrit says adi, etc. So all those things, of course, the first in the list of offenses against the holy name, the first list is sadhu-ninda. So it may refer to this list and so on. And so not just that, but that's the person who is really not committing offenses to the holy name, especially this one. Here also, another verse in this connection not mentioned here, from Majjalila 2287, Mahaprabhu says, Asat Sangha Tyaga, E Vaishnav Achara. They asked him, what's the characteristic behavior, Achara, of a Vaishnava? And he says, Asat Sangha Tyaga. He has given up the association of those people who are asat, materialistic or not devotees. Asat Sangha Tyaga. This is the Vaishnava Acharya, the behavior of a Vaishnava. And then he goes on to mention two kinds of people who are asad, or here asadu in that verse there, eka asadu. One is stri sangi, one who associates with women for sense gratification. Or we can make it a little more general, members of the opposite sex, because as Prabhupada said in a lecture, for a man, woman is the woman. For a woman, man is the woman. So the woman means the sex object. So one who has this association with members of the opposite sex for sense gratification, that's one kind of eka asadu, that's one kind of unsaintly person. And the other, Krishna abhakta, one who's not a devotee. He's Krishna abhakta, not devoted to Krishna. So interesting, these two are there, because there may be others that are Krishna bhaktas who are still Sri Sanghi, because they're mentioned as two different kinds. Then, if we go on, the next, in this, the text here, let's see. Yeah, then we go on to the next paragraph, the fourth paragraph. However, if there is a materialistic person that approaches a devotee with a sincere, inquisitive desire for spiritual learning, then you can associate. And that's where this daya is there. In other words, that you're associating to answer their inquiries about a devotional service. So that kind of association is there. with materialistic people. To associate with such people for sense gratification is definitely leads to problems. One has to be careful. Somewhere it's mentioned about spiritual masters not taking on too many disciples, and Prabhupada says that one may take lots of disciples, and sometimes because they have money and they're rich and things like that, or that in order to get more disciples, one initiates people who are very materialistic. And then people who are materialistic will start to offer the spiritual master sense gratification. Their idea of devotional service is to say, hey, you know, I know a really cool place to go and you'll have a good time. And so the service they offer to the spiritual master is various kinds of facilities for sense gratification, and therefore the spiritual master may find himself in a dangerous position. So that's sometimes a danger of somebody who associating with somebody who is not a devotee. If they're inquisitive about devotional service, okay. But then if there's also some opportunity to act on that level, then there's a problem. Then there's the next paragraph quotes the Garuda Purana about mercy, which is a nice quotation here. One cannot be liberated without association with a pure devotee of the Lord, and unless one shows mercy to those in an inferior position, one's life will be superficial. It will not be full, it will be incomplete. So this is this principle of giving mercy. One should do this. If we are devotees, it is only because we have received mercy from somebody who cared for us and gave us the mercy of Krishna consciousness. And the way to, and we're indebted. And so the way to pay that back is to also give the same mercy to other people. So these two things, this goes together, receiving mercy, serving somebody who is more advanced, and receiving mercy from that person, and then also the obligation is there to give mercy to others. So everyone who's a devotee should do that. One way or another, there should be everyone should have some kind of preaching program. Maybe all kinds of different ways. The one that's usually cited in ISKCON is book distribution. And there's that. But then there's so many other ways also that one can associate with others. But the point is to give people Krishna consciousness somehow or other, in whatever circumstance it may be. If the occasion doesn't arise in a natural way, then I should somehow make an occasion to do that. And that's my obligation. Another paragraph, sixth paragraph, points out that if one is himself engaged in sense gratification, he cannot be merciful. So that we understand, because you let me see what else is in here, and then let's. And then there's a final paragraph about association with those who are more advanced. We've already discussed that pretty much. So that's the first discussion, the first verse that's discussing here, this last 23rd, the relations of a disciple toward others. Detachment and attachment, and three different ways of dealing with people. The Maitri, with friendship with devotees, is very, very important. By the way, there's not much attention paid to it in the purport here, but it seems often to be a stumbling block of friendship with devotees. If we cannot cultivate friendship with devotees, then we will be deprived of devotional association, and it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to make advancement outside of devotional association. Because when I'm by myself, I'm associating with my mind, and for most of us, the mind is not good association. If you're advanced, then it's okay, but if otherwise, so to be by yourself is to be in, just take it as to be in bad association. So those who are other devotees in the path of devotional service, is necessary to cultivate friendship with devotees. And how to do that's also described in Upadeshamrita, different exchanges. And in this way, one can develop the kind of friendship that's necessary. So that means not a materialistic relationship. It means working together in devotional service with other devotees. And in that context, developing friendships. So let's go on to text number 24. This is a list of qualities. It's simply a list of the translation says, to serve the spiritual master, the disciple should learn. Well, that's the context. Those words aren't in the text, but that's the implication from the context of the verse. One is, again, the answer. The thing is how that one has to surrender to a spiritual master. So necessarily, these things are necessary for that. So here's this list. Saucham tapas titiksham cha. Cha means and. Maunam swadhyayam arjavam. Brahmacharyam ahimsa. And there's samatvam dvanda samjnayaha. That's a single one. So saucham, cleanliness, tapaha, austerity, titiksham, tolerance. We'll talk about all of these a little bit. Titiksham, tolerance, maunam, silence, swadhyayam, study of the Vedas, arjavam, simplicity, brahmacharyam, celibacy, ahimsa, non-violence, and samatvam dvanda samjnayaha, equanimity in the face of various dualities, heat and cold, happiness and distress, and so on. All those things, one is not disturbed. So this is this list of virtues that disciples should cultivate. excuse me. Get the text up here. My screen. Yeah, so saucham, cleanliness. This means, it's explained here, internal and external purity. Purity of the mind and purity of the body. That means bathing at least once a day, three times. But a lot of people don't. At least once a day. Really, like sannyasis, three times a day. So, socham, cleanliness, And then it says here in the purport, one is considered internally pure when he's free from the pollution of false pride and egoism. So the mental cleanliness comes through the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. That's the soap for the mind, which requires constant immersion, bathing perpetually almost. So one has to be clean. There's that mantra we chant, Pavitro a Pavitro va Sarva vastam gatopi va yasmanet pundarikaksham sabaya antaraha suchihi. One is clean inside and out by always remembering the lotus feet remembering the lotus-eyed Lord, so that even in one's in difficult or nasty circumstances, one is still clean. That's the bath. That says inside and out, too. It's true, actually, if somehow or other you can't take a bath in water, like if you're in the army, or there's some kind of water failure and there's no water available, then you can take bath with the Hare Krishna mantra. That's true. It works that way also. So that's socham. But if there's water available, you should use it. Then there's socham tapas, austerity. There's quite a few paragraphs. No, there's not much here on austerity, actually. It just says austerity means that fixed in executing his proper duties in life, controlling anger, lust, greed, and anger, and so on. I want to refer you, however, to the Bhagavad Gita. It's not mentioned in the purport, chapter 17, where there's a threefold austerity is discussed. This is beginning with text 14, 15, and 16. Austerity of the body, austerity of the mind, of speech, and austerity of the mind. This is this threefold austerity that should never be given up. And so, just to refresh your memory, austerity of the body consists in worship of the Supreme Lord, the Brahmanas, the spiritual masters, and superiors like the father and mother. Pujanam, Deva, Dvija, Guru, Prajna, Pujanam. Worship of these things, Deva, Dvija, Guru, Prajna. Then Socham. See here, Socham is mentioned, but it's also considered an austerity of the body. Arjamam, also mentioned here, is also considered in the Bhagavad Gita an austerity of the body, interestingly enough. Simplicity, brahmacharyam, celibacy, and ahimsa. These are all austerities pertaining to the body. And then in text 15, the austerities pertaining to vak, speech or the voice. It means speaking words that are truthful, satyam, but anuvega karam, do not cause agitation of the mind. That's a real trick, huh? Telling the truth, but in such a way, so nicely, that nobody is disturbed to hear it. Usually we tell people the truth just to upset them. I'm going to tell you the truth about yourself. Me, hold up a mirror to your ugly face. Anuvega karam, not agitating. So that's the austerity. You speak the truth, but in such a way that it's pleasing. This is an art. Truthful, pleasing, beneficial, not agitating. Also, that's also mentioned, hit them. That is going to benefit. Sometimes you tell some people the truth, it will not help them. It's not beneficial, and so you know, then also there. So that's kind of speech, is there that has these truthful, pleasing, beneficial, and not agitating to others. And also in Swadhyaya, that's mentioned here in this verse here too, Swadhyaya, study of the Vedas, or here speaking the Vedas or reciting the Vedas. And then the Bhagavad Gita text number 16, these are the austerities of the mind. One is being satisfied. Mana prasada. One is being satisfied. That's austere, to be satisfied sometimes. Just accept what you've got. Somyatvam, being without duplicity towards others. Maunam, which Prabhupada translates here as gravity, being grave. That is not babbling out everything that's in your mind. You don't have to share all your thoughts with everybody. Being grave. Something you don't see on the talk shows, television. Self-control, and purification of one's existence are the austerities of the mind. That's a nice list there, and that's always worth studying also. So that's tapas, avoiding sense gratification. The next one, titiksham, is very, very interesting qualification. It comes from the verb tij, which means to be sharp or firm, or to become sharp or firm, and it's a verbal form of that, to desire to become sharp or firm, or to bear with firmness, suffer with courage or patience, endure. So I think here in this text it's translated as tolerance. Titikshataha is, for example, it shows up in the Bhagavatam as a quality of Maharaj Yudhisthira. He's called, this is in the third canto, first chapter, text 11, Vidura is talking to Dhritarashtra, and he says to him, you must now return the legitimate share to Yudhisthira, who has no enemies and who has been forbearing, that's the, through untold suffering due to your offenses. He's called Titikshataha, one who is forbearing, tolerant, because Yudhisthira himself, he's called Ajatashataho, he who has no enemies, meaning he who does not consider anyone his enemies. Other people may make themselves his enemy, but he himself doesn't consider anyone his enemy. In other words, he's like, wishes everyone well. That's Yudhisthira's quality. And he's been very forbearing because of Durvishaham Tava Agaha, because of your, in the face of your unbearable offenses, your untold sufferings due to your offenses. So there are many examples in Bhagavatam of devotees who have had this quality of forbearance or patience, even though they have every right to be disturbed. They are not disturbed. Then there's the interesting word maunam, silent. The word maunam comes from Muni, the sages, who typically took a vow of silence. And so it means that you're like that, silent. Everywhere this is mentioned that here in the second paragraph, for example, the purport, maunam, or silence, means that one should not speak on worthless or frivolous topics. And that's what Prabhupada calls it, grave. Because, of course, we don't literally take a vow of silence. There are sages, and also in the West, some especially Roman Catholic orders which follow a vow of silence. But the silence should also be mental. You shouldn't even think of garbage. I read an account of somewhere here in Philadelphia, there was some order of Catholic nuns who had a vow of silence they followed, except there was about 2 hours on Sunday when they can talk, and the reporter was there when the stuff they'd been saving up all week long came pouring out. So this is, it's more than just external silence. And Prabhupada said one place that chanting Hare Krishna is silence. That is to say, there's no material sound. So when the mind is filled with topics of Krishna, then that is silence, like that. Okay. Swadhyayam. This is, again, study of the Vedas. We have a huge literature for us. There's plenty of stuff to study. That should be done. Arjavam, simplicity. This is also, you may notice, in the qualities of a brahmana. This is one of them. Arjavam. It means literally straight. That is to say, not crooked. Here, if you look at down here in the fourth paragraph, the word arjavam indicates simplicity or straightforwardness. According to Srila Sridhar Swami, one of the commentators, the original first commentator of the Bhagavatam, swachatam, or clarity, transparency, is a synonym for straightforwardness. As Arjunam. A person is transparent. In a devotee, there shouldn't be, what you see is what you get. There shouldn't be trap doors, hidden compartments, I don't know, when I was in college, the virtue was to have a really complicated mind. Everybody's supposed to become really complicated and intricate. And really, just the opposite should be a devotee. They should just have this simplicity. It's an extraordinary thing to study Srila Prabhupada and finally realize just how simple he was. Simple thing. He was given an order by his spiritual master, and he was doing whatever he had to do to satisfy him. Period. That was it. That was the sum total of his motivation. Very, very simple. Not complicated. Complicated means there's many other things going on other than your main thing, and then in order to kind of integrate them, then you have to have systems and and qualifications and so on. Brahmacharyam, it said in the purport here that brahmacharyam means basically it's Eve. Well, Prabhupada also discusses this in the Bhagavad Gita. He talks about that. There's also the householder brahmachari, the brahmachari householder, one who strictly follows the regular principles and only engages in sexual life, sexual activity in order to beget God-conscious children, following the principles of Vrindadhana Samskara. That's also considered to be a brahmachari. And it says the similar thing is in here. So ahimsa, non-violence. Prabhupada says somewhere also that not to preach Krishna consciousness is violence. There's a kind of passive violence, you know. That in other words, if you have the ability, you don't hurt anybody, but you have the ability to stop some pain, and you don't do it, that's also a kind of violence. So to knowing about Krishna consciousness, being able to cure the disease of material existence, of birth and death in the material world, and not giving it to people, then that's a kind of violence, not intervening. Every time there's some disaster, the UN or somebody's supposed to go in and just stop it. And if they don't, they're considered to be also passively culpable. You can do so. And then, just to finish up, samatvam dvanda samjnayaha. So the dualities are there in the material world. It's the world of desire and hate and friends and enemies and happiness and distress. And one should have the not to be batted around by these. Most people are running back and forth, you know, trying to totally controlled by these dualities. And when there's some good fortune, they're overjoyed, and then when bad fortune comes, they're cast down. Their team wins, they're exalted. Their team loses, they're miserable, you know. Devotees should be the same. You know, all these things. Should not be a sports fan. Or even be a sports fan of the game of life, as they call it. So this is the list of these qualities. So, excuse me. So I guess we've come to the end of our allotted time. Next week, the next verse keeps going on with a list of some interesting sorts of behavior, which we can discuss. Devotee. So let me just now switch to the Q&A mode by pressing my little *7. Hold on. Okay, the Q&A mode is on, and the participants can unmute themselves individually by pressing *6, and your voice can be heard. Anyone? There's an in-house question by an unphoned person.
Gurudev?
Yeah, okay, go for it.
Please accept my humble obeisances.
Thanks
for another inspiring and painful class.
Painful? Was it painful?
Well, it's painful that it reminds me of my many shortcomings.
Well,
it's
not
a good pain.
But we're supposed to speak in such a way that it doesn't cause distress.
Well, I suppose that... you know, when someone has some kind of mental disturbance and you can't but cause them pain when speaking to them, maybe that rule can, you know, there's legitimate violations, I suppose.
I suppose, but one should also, in these things, when we discuss these things which cause, when we look at our lack of these things, we should also have hope that it's actually possible to overcome these whatever shortcomings we have and get there. At least we should keep these in mind. I always like to stress to people that our standard for judging ourselves and others should not be static. You know, are you this or that? You know, we have very, very high ideals. You know, you read something like this and you can say, oh man, that's not for me. You know, I'll never make it. You can get discouraged. But they're here for us so that we know what we should progress to. And so if we are we fall short of what we ought to be, but if we're sincerely trying to become better, then we're okay. We only have a problem if we quit, we take a break, a cigarette break from Krishna consciousness. Don't take any breaks, you know. keep on with confidence. One should aspire with confidence that it can be done. Okay, go ahead.
Well, sorry, just one other response to that. It seems like, much of the time in my life when I read passages which describe an ideal that I'm not up to yet, it's been a kind of good pain, like, I don't know, like an athlete, when you're stretching, your hamstrings hurt, but it kind of gets you ready. You know, but there are times where, for whatever reason, maybe the ideal seems so distant that it's a different kind of pain. But that's a side note, I guess. So.
Yeah, we want the healing pain, right?
So my question is about silence and our practice as devotees. And I remember, I think as part of Srila Prabhupada's overall articulation of our tradition in response to the kind of Advaita Vedanta that people think is just Hinduism, Prabhupada would generally attack that notion that silence is a kind of high ideal because, you know, rocks are silent and things like that. We want to speak about Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, though, that, you know, given that Prabhupada successfully uprooted that failed notion, at least for us and for much of the world, it seems, do you think that we can say there is a proper place for even temporary vows of silence and things like that?
Yeah, we started doing that. A lot of times when we have japa retreats, the ones I've been on, when the day that we decide to chant 64 rounds, we also take a vow of silence. But, of course, we're chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. So we're not exactly silent because we're going Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. But what it does is eliminates chit-chat, unnecessary chit-chat, and kind of concentrates the mind. So, you know, you judge anything, whether it's favorable or not favorable to Krishna consciousness. And in that circumstance, it seems to be quite favorable. So that's what we observe it. So we also see among the six Goswamis, there's a description somewhere that when they honored prasadam, they didn't say a word. They ate in silence. That they would. Just say Hare Krishna, something like that. But otherwise, they simply honor the prasadam in silence and would not really remark, like if something had too much salt, they would wait a couple of weeks before they said anything about it. And the reason for that silence is that one should actually, since you're involving the sense of taste during prasadam, you should concentrate on that sense. And actually, in my early experience in ISKCON, that's how we would honor prasadam. We wouldn't talk. Later, when we had restaurants, that's kind of eroded that principle. And just at the Sunday feast, you have to talk, and so we. We do the things, and I'm very guilty and not really like just concentrating on the taste of, you know, I read something, but anyway, that's how one should honor prasadam. And so if you're not talking, it's still okay, it's still good. It's good, concentrates the mind on the other sense, the sense of taste, later in Vrindavan, I met this, I forgot his name now, he's an Ayurvedic doctor. And he said that it's actually an Ayurvedic principle that when you're eating, you don't talk. That it's important for your digestion that you just concentrate and absorb your mind in the process of eating. That you eat with your hands because digestion begins with the hands, and you feel the heat and the texture of the food and prepares your stomach, and then you chew it very slowly and savor it, and you know, that's just like a general Ayurvedic principle, not to talk while you're eating. So you know, there are occasions where it's appropriate, I think, be silent. Also, if somebody's giving a talk and we're all listening, the audience is typically silent. that's also appropriate. So just here, you're all muted. So you have to observe a vow of silence in certain circumstances. So it has, but this thing where you don't speak anything, that's the point of silence, is to concentrate the mind on Krishna. And that's why Prabhupada is chanting Hare Krishna silence. If there's transcendental sound, then there's no problem. So the idea of silence is not to have material sounds. And you also have to observe the interior silence, the silence of the mind. But then, you know, the Trappist monks who are silent have a very elaborate sign language. There was another, I forgot who his name is, some Indian yogi or guru who was famous for a vow of silence. And he just wrote on a chalkboard that he carried around. That kind of defeats the purpose, I think. But anyway, if it's important to Krishna consciousness, it's fine.
Do you think there's a way to understand those, like that yogi and stuff, to say that, well, they're not necessarily hypocrites, but they're putting up like high barriers to communication. So even that alone is a bit of an austerity. I mean, maybe he was a hypocrite.
I don't know. Yeah.
But do you know what I mean? I mean, I don't know if I'd necessarily think he was a hypocrite. I would maybe, a little slate. But it's a big difference between having a slate and just being able to allow yourself to talk. Wouldn't you say? Or
depends.
Yeah.
It depends on what you do, you know. I mean, you know, some necessary communication is there, but if your mind, the point is, if your mind is a chatterbox, then you're not observing silence either. And if you find some way to write everything down or use sign language, obviously the deaf people who converse wildly in sign language, you know, are talking. They just have another way of talking. You know, because the ears are not working, they do it visually, but it's definitely talking. Very vehement talk. You can tell when somebody deaf is yelling at it, doing sign. So, you know, we just have to understand what the purport is of this is. But you know, behind the conventional idea of Malnam is that transcendence cannot be, there can't be any such thing as transcendental sound. That's the main argument we have. And plus the idea that suppression of speech is itself unnatural. Sound and speech are actually characteristic of spiritual existence. And the Vedas themselves are sound. The stutis of the sages are sound. I mean, who says, you know, you shouldn't speak like that? So you know, anything that's spoken in glorification of Krishna or in the service of Krishna is not a material sound. And, you know, but when you get into this Mayavada idea, obviously the Vedas are also Maya, right?
Yeah.
They are. Although they know it's Maya by the Vedas, I mean, somehow or other. it's also Maya. But that's just misleading people. Let's see if there's something else. Anyone else?
Thanks, Krishna.
Okay, you're welcome. Hi, Krishna. Here's Ratnabhushana. Someone is handing him a phone. You're in the studio audience.
Just a short comment first on this potential reaction of despondency. to the ideals of Krishna consciousness. I was reading a book by Thomas Keating, In Relation to Love. He's a Christian writer. He gave a definition of humility. He said, the experiential awareness that without God's protection, you're capable of every sin. And he was talking about how, and when God lets you in to our weakness and deficiencies, it's not to overwhelm us with discouragement, but to encourage us to entrust ourselves completely to his infinite mercy. I thought that was interesting.
That's a good point. Thank you.
And just my question was if you could kindly comment on when not beneficial telling the truth. That was one of the points.
When it's not beneficial to tell somebody the truth?
Right.
Sometimes Prabhupada didn't tell us the truth because it was not beneficial. He did. But, well, like, for example, when he said Krishna consciousness is easy. Now, he probably knew how he understood that. That it's something like you put in the microwave oven, in 5 minutes it's done. You know, the American idea of easy. It's true that it's easy if you compare it to any other bona fide spiritual process. But if you compare it to if you compare it to cheating spiritual processes, then it's difficult. So we probably had the wrong idea in the beginning. I know we did it. You just chant Hare Krishna and everything will go away. It turns out there's a lot more to it. So sometimes it's not beneficial for somebody to tell at least the whole truth or not to let them know absolutely everything. I'm trying to think of some other incidences. Nothing comes to my mind right away, but there's been time when, like, telling people the whole truth or making everything clear right away will not help them. It'll just be so overwhelming or so discouraging or whatever it is. So sometimes it's not appropriate. Because there's a truthfulness and then there's also a mercy and they might sometimes come into be inappropriate. In conflict with mercy. Of course, that can also be misused, obviously. And just out of laziness, people don't tell the truth. Doctors all the time don't tell the patient the truth. And they might be better off actually knowing it, but they don't know how to do it in such a way. They don't have the skills to tell the truth in such a way that it's not disturbing in mind. Well, if the truth is that you're going to be dead in 6 months, that may be disturbing in any case, but, you know, you have to know it. So they just keep so many things from them. So it's not an excuse to keep people in illusion. But I can think of times when it wouldn't be exactly appropriate. That's all I can say. Anything else? Anyone else? Yeah? Anita has a question or comment.
I have a question that, are there instances when tolerance is not, can be not beneficial? Like, are we supposed to tolerate any circumstances we're in, or do we have to be, discriminate? Yes, we always have to discriminate, but then, yeah, that's my question. Do we tolerate every circumstance?
We wouldn't want to tolerate a circumstance which was others were being harmed. This usually it's spoken of in reference to oneself. And usually it's often spoken of in the things that cannot be changed. We just are in circumstances somewhere that can't be changed. If we are in circumstances that are very, very unfavorable to Krishna consciousness, and staying in that condition will prevent us from becoming Krishna conscious, then obviously we should try to change the situation. But first, you know, we should try to do everything we can. My own experience is that if in our present condition we find that there are things in that are not favorable to Krishna consciousness, first of all, under whatever circumstance we are in, we should do everything we can just to tolerate it. And just whatever that circumstance is, do everything one can for advancement in Krishna consciousness. And my experience is that if we do that, and now to make more advancements, my circumstance has to change, Krishna will see to it that it changes. I mean, he's in our hearts as a super soul. He's wants us to make spiritual advancement. He's not in the business of frustrating our spiritual advancement. And sometimes, of course, we're not always good at judging what's adverse or not. You may think something is adverse and actually it's beneficial, even though it appears to be adverse. We don't know for sure. Krishna knows. So accepting that he's in charge and he's in control, that if I'm in a difficult situation that I cannot get out of and it seems like it's harmful for my Krishna consciousness, I should nevertheless, in that situation, try to do everything I can. So you'll see, for example, that Prabhupada was in a marriage that apparently for a very long time that was not favorable for his Krishna consciousness. He was doing things that were favorable to his Krishna consciousness, like not making as much money as he could. And he gained the hostility of his wife and apparently his wife's family. But he just tolerated it. And he just went on because he had his duties also, and he was able to keep on increasing his Krishna consciousness. But then a certain point came when he realized he couldn't go anymore, when she sold his Bhagavatams for tea biscuits, as he tells the story. And then he decided he had to leave home. And he'd already also had some dreams when the spiritual master was coming to him and telling him he had to do it. That was the other factor. But when? Well, when that happened. So there's an example of somebody who's very, very tolerant for a very, very long time and somehow still able to execute Krishna consciousness. But when it finally came impossible, then he changed. Oh, then, anyway, somehow the possibilities opened up to him. He didn't take sannyas right away either. He also went out and did other things, and he, you know, kept up relationships. But basically, he changed a bunch of stuff. Okay.
Thank you.
Anything else? Anything else? Okay. So, if you're observing Janmashtami today, I wish you all a happy Janmashtami. And we'll talk again next week, next Sunday morning. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.